This is a CBC podcast.
Yesterday, I said the clock was ticking. Today, I'm saying the alarm bell's going off.
I think this is going to be one of the biggest ones that we have seen after it makes landfall, and this one is different.
Because of the last storm, there's nowhere to go.
House is damaged here. Tornado damage right here, guys.
At this point, it's too late to leave and too early to know just how bad it will be. Hurricane Milton has started lashing the state of Florida, but the storm's powerful core isn't expected to hit until late tonight, somewhere along the densely populated Gulf Coast, where millions have been told to evacuate. But with roads clogged, leaving is difficult, while staying behind is extremely dangerous. Welcome to Your World Tonight. I'm Susan Bonner. It is Wednesday, October 9th, coming up on 6 p.m. Eastern. Also on the podcast,
housing costs, cost of living, even folks that are earning incomes that we would have thought would be more than sufficient in previous times are really feeling some financial stress and feeling the pinch.
Hustling on the side just to stay ahead. More and more Canadians who already have full-time jobs are working in the gig economy. And for many, it's not a hobby, but a necessity to keep up with this country's rising cost of living. Even before making landfall, Hurricane Milton pounded Florida's Gulf Coast this afternoon. The outer edges of the storm producing torrential rain and tornadoes with even more powerful winds, and a life-threatening storm surge forecast for later tonight. The CBC's Katie Simpson is in Florida with the latest.
High winds and heavy rain whip up waves and debris along Florida's Gulf Coast, an eerie preview of what's to come as Hurricane Milton inches closer to shore. By all measures, this is expected to be nothing short of catastrophic. Storm surge predictions of up to 4 meters, winds upwards of 200 kilometers per hour, fears of flash flooding, and there are already reports of damaging tornadoes.
Yesterday, I said the clock was ticking. Today, I'm saying the alarm bell's going off. People really need to start getting into their safe place.
Ken Graham, the director of the National Weather Service, is the latest authority to plead with people to take this storm seriously. Evacuation orders are in place for parts of Tampa and Sarasota, where the worst of the storm is expected to make landfall tonight.
It's looking like the storm of the century.
U.S. President Joe Biden says first responders are in place to help, though conditions will be so dangerous, at least one local sheriff, Chad Cronister, warns rescue missions may be impossible for some time.
Imagine that sickening feeling that I can't even think about when you figure it out, like, hey, I shouldn't be here. Hey, I need help. And help's not coming.
Many residents have listened to the warnings, and the urgent rush to escape Milton's path has come with challenges of its own. Highways out of Gulf Coast communities have been jammed, and nearly a quarter of the state's gas stations have either run out or run low on fuel. And while coastal communities are expected to be hit hardest, this storm is so powerful and so large, huge swaths of central Florida are also bracing for dangerous conditions. Just outside of Orlando, in a mobile home park that has a history of flooding, we met Charisse Laterullo as she packed up her family minivan. She's taking her elderly parents and kids to a nearby hotel to wait this out.
We're just scared what's going to happen to our house because this is all we have. We don't have family here.
In this trailer park, a handful of homes have been boarded up. Cars are parked strategically in driveways to prevent looters from entering. It's a scene that stunned Sheila Nemac as she drove around the neighborhood in a golf cart. She's new to Florida and has never lived through a hurricane.
At this point, I am beyond scared because I didn't even realize all these people boarded up and locked down their houses.
Adding to the misery here, some of these communities are still recovering from Hurricane Helene, which hit less than 2 weeks ago. Huge piles of debris could be swept up into this storm, becoming dangerous projectiles. Conditions have been deteriorating hour by hour. There is a real sense of fear and unease here, as everyone waits for everything to get worse. Katie Simpson, CBC News, Orlando, Florida.
Milton comes just 2 weeks after another deadly hurricane hit the same state, and the pair come on the tail end of an unusually quiet season. So why are these storms so powerful? Science reporter Nicole Mortellaro has more.
It has dropped 50 millibars in 10 hours. I apologize. This is just horrific.
Climatologists like John Morales looked on with incredulity and fear this week as Hurricane Milton's air pressure, measured in millibars, dropped rapidly, indicating an intensification of the storm. Over the past 2 years, Earth's oceans have experienced record-breaking temperatures. At the time Milton formed, temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico were close to 4 degrees Celsius warmer than average. Daniel Guilford is a climate scientist at Climate Central, a nonprofit group of independent scientists.
Hurricanes are a lot like the engine in your car. They need some fuel in order to be able to spin. And so as you ramp up that fuel source, as you increase the temperature and the energy that can go into this storm, it can take that energy, convert it into winds, and just be incredibly intense.
Milton jumped from a Category 1 hurricane to a powerful Category 5 in roughly a day and a half, making it the fifth most intense hurricane on record in the Atlantic Basin. This is called rapid intensification, where a tropical storm or hurricane strengthens exponentially in a very short time. Hurricanes need a sea surface temperature of 26 degrees Celsius to form, but in the Gulf of Mexico, where Milton formed, it's much warmer. Frederick Fabry is a professor at McGill University's Oceanic and Atmospheric Sciences Department.
Now we're talking of 30 degrees in the Gulf of Mexico. And we expect these kinds of temperatures to become more of the norm in the future, both in the Gulf of Mexico and to a lesser extent in the Atlantic.
Warmer ocean waters are a direct result of pumping greenhouse gases into our atmosphere, where 90% of that warmth is taken up by our oceans.
These sea surface temperatures would not have been as warm as they are without climate change intervening. It has the fingerprints of humanity all over it.
And we're not only warming sea surfaces, we're increasing temperatures below the surface as well. Ben Kirtman, professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Miami.
If there's a lot of cold water below, that storm can then cool off the ocean and, at the surface. And so when you have a deep layer, you're getting much less of a cooling effect.
But with warmer ocean temperatures down to the depths of 200 meters, that cooling effect that could otherwise help weaken a hurricane just isn't there. There's a fear that as our climate continues to warm and our oceans, these storms experiencing rapid intensification won't be rare occurrences at all. Nicole Mortellaro, CBC News, Toronto.
Coming up on the podcast, Israel ups its threats against Iran as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and U.S. President Joe Biden meet by phone to talk about the crisis, plus the latest twists in the BC election campaign. U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke on a crucial call today, their first direct conversation in weeks. The leaders discussed Israel's retaliation plan for a recent Iranian missile barrage. It comes as Israel and Hezbollah traded more deadly bombardments. Chris Brown reports from northern Israel.
In northern Israel, alerts from incoming Hezbollah missiles were constant for much of the day, with the white streaks of Israeli interceptors filling the blue skies, knocking out most of the incoming rockets, but not all. The worst damage was in the town of Kiryat Shemona, where a couple reportedly out walking their dog were killed. In Haifa, 5 people were sent to hospital with injuries. Our CBC News team visited the scene of an earlier strike that knocked a hole in the roof of an apartment building, leaving missile fragments everywhere but not causing any injuries. There was a big noise and lots of dust and a lot of water exploded, said the maintenance manager David Vaknin, who had been in the apartment just 30 seconds before. People can't live here because they're afraid to come back and sleep here. On the ground floor below, Gennady Tobias was sitting outside his fishing shop, watching CCTV footage of the previous day's explosion. He's supportive of Israel's actions against Hezbollah in Lebanon. I think it's very good, he said. What did Netanyahu say? This is for generations to come, that there won't be any wars anymore. After having much of its leadership assassinated by Israel, Hezbollah has tried to project strength with its mass rocket fires and claiming that Israeli troops have made little progress on the ground. In a statement, the Israel Defense Forces says its soldiers engaged in close quarter encounters with Hezbollah fighters on the ground in southern Lebanon, as well as carrying out more airstrikes. More than 1,000 Lebanese have been killed in the last 2 weeks by Israeli strikes, according to health officials, including 4 today near Sidon, after an attack on a building that housed displaced families, said the village mayor. Without specifically mentioning Israel, in a briefing, U.S. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller warned about letting the destruction escalate.
We cannot and must not see the situation in Lebanon turn into anything like the situation in Gaza.
As the Lebanon front intensifies, Israel's government continues to weigh its response to Iran's enormous salvo of missiles that it says it fired at Israeli military targets on October the 1st. The latest Israeli politician warning that something big is coming without saying what, when, or how was the defense minister, Yoav Gallant. Our attack will be deadly, precise, and above all surprising, he said. They will not understand what happened and how it happened. They'll see the results. U.S. President Joe Biden had his first phone call in weeks with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Amid reports, the two men have had serious disagreements over many issues, including Israel's response to Iran. Without releasing details, a White House official said the call was productive. Chris Brown, CBC News in Haifa.
The United Nations is warning more than 60% of Gaza's cropland has been damaged in the conflict. Satellite surveys also show more than half of the agricultural wells have been damaged. The UN Director of Emergencies and Resilience, Rain Paulsen, says that will worsen the humanitarian and hunger crisis.
What this latest round of assessments is telling us is that where we had a situation of, to a large extent, self-sufficiency when it came to agricultural production before the escalation in hostilities, we're seeing a continued worsening of capabilities, capacities, and substantial destruction of the productive sector.
The damage is compounded because the lack of crops means Gazan farmers can't feed their animals. UN data suggests only 1% of the poultry in the country have survived. It's been a highly unusual election campaign in British Columbia, with changes in parties and riding boundaries and the number of seats at the legislature. Now there are just 10 days left until the vote. And as Lindsay Duncombe tells us, the policy options are vague and the outcome uncertain.
It is horrendous what is happening here.
This TV debate was the chance for BC Conservative leader John Rustad to take the anger he's channeled and make the case he's ready to be premier. Rustad laid out BC's problems.
Tent cities are growing all over the place. We have a crisis in health care. We've got a crisis in affordability. We've got a crisis in housing.
But UBC political scientist Richard Johnston isn't so sure he connected with voters.
He's identified the flashpoints. But yet he came across as kind of bland.
The rise of the BC Conservatives has so far been the story of this election. The other right-of-center party, BC United, suspended its campaign in August. At times, the BC Conservatives pulled ahead of the NDP, promising smaller government and tax cuts.
How can we debate you when you won't even say what you're going to cut?
NDP leader David Eby went into the debate on the defensive.
We can't govern through conspiracy theories, cuts, and divisiveness. We can only solve this together.
The NDP may have received a boost from an unexpected source. Billionaire Lululemon founder Chip Wilson posted signs outside his Vancouver mansion calling the governing party communist.
It might actually be the TSN, quote-unquote, turning point for this election.
Political watcher and former BC Liberal advisor Kareem Allam says Wilson's stunt may have backfired on the billionaire.
It's given the NDP an opportunity to say, I'm fighting for you, the average person. I'm not fighting for the billionaires like John Rustad is.
Tuesday's debate focused on the economy, public safety, and healthcare, but didn't focus enough on climate change, according to former Nature of Things host and BC voter David Suzuki.
For heaven's sakes, what is a big picture? And if any province should be at the forefront of dealing with climate change, it should be British Columbia. You know, it's not normal to have the kind of fires that we have every year now.
They're aligned on continuing to drag us back to a fossil fuel age when the rest of the world is moving forward.
The person who did bring up climate change, Green Party leader Sonja Fürstenau. Pundits point out she had a strong debate, but she's running in a different riding where it will be tough to get reelected. To complicate things even more, there are six new ridings in BC and six incumbent MLAs running as independents. With more than a week to go, much is uncertain. Lindsay Duncombe, CBC News, Vancouver.
A new survey suggests about a quarter of Canadians do some kind of work in the gig economy. For some, it's about more flexibility or a creative outlet. But a major driver for many is the rising cost of living. As Susanna De Silva reports, more than half of those doing gig work already have a full-time job.
It's very busy.
Downtime is hard to come by for Emma Sui, full-time tech worker for a Canadian airline, part-time photographer.
After working hour, if I'm not doing photo shoots and I'm editing photos or editing videos.
She took up photography after losing her job during COVID. But even after getting another full-time job, she didn't stop.
If I just work on my full-time job, it would be literally paycheck to paycheck. There would be very minimal saving on the side.
Her story is one shared by millions of Canadians, according to a new survey by insurance company Securian in partnership with the Angus Reid Institute. Chief Executive Officer Nigel Branker says the survey found almost one quarter of Canadians, or about 7.3 million people, are doing gig work, that is short-term contract or one-off project jobs.
We often think of gig work as, you know, ride sharing or food delivery, but those are relatively small single digit percentages. I mean, there's a lot of diverse gig work out there, like dog walking, photography, consulting, digital platforms.
The survey found over half of gig workers are already employed full time in more traditional jobs, and more than 50% are doing it because of the rising cost of living or to be able to put money aside.
They do struggle to meet their financial objectives, such as savings. They're not well equipped for surprises from a day-to-day cash flow.
And those financial gaps are even being felt by high earners. The survey found 44% of gig workers earned more than $100,000 from their primary job. University of British Columbia labor market researcher Sylvia Fuller finds that surprising.
Housing costs, cost of living situation, where even folks that are earning incomes that we would have thought would be more than sufficient in previous times are really feeling some financial stress and feeling the pinch.
But she says it is employers who have been pushing the trend for years.
They're really looking to increasingly not hire people as part of their permanent workforce, but in these more temporary contracts where they don't have that sort of longstanding employment obligation to workers.
For Emma Sui, her photography gig has taken off with some high-profile clients.
If I want to travel and enjoy life a little bit, and if I don't have that photography money, I won't be able to do that.
Like many Canadians, her side gig is now a much-needed part of life. Susanna De Silva, CBC News, Vancouver.
An Ontario hospital network is apologizing for shaving a sick patient's beard without consent, violating his religious beliefs. A statement says the staff at Brampton Civic Hospital failed to uphold religious and cultural care practices. It says the network will make changes to its procedures. The World Sick Organization of Canada welcomes the apology, but says there is still a lot of work to do to ensure such a serious breach never happens again. It's opening night for hockey in Montreal as the Canadiens host the Maple Leafs in their home opener. But as the season gets underway, watching games is now more complicated and costly. Senior business reporter Peter Armstrong explains how streaming giants are getting a piece of the action.
Have a good season. And we are underway. Bob
pushes it alongside AJ.
As the puck drops on a new season, it's hard not to feel optimistic. New hope for fans, a new team in Utah. Everyone gets a fresh start. This season doesn't just come with new storylines, though. It comes with new ways to watch as well.
It's on Prime.
Amazon Prime is now streaming some NHL games after making a deal with Rogers. All told, there are more choices and more games, but that comes at a cost. To watch every NHL game this season, you'll need to subscribe to Sportsnet, TSN, TVA, and Amazon Prime.
I think we're headed for an era of greater complication.
That's Kerry Kaplan, founder and president of Cosmos Sports. He says Rogers' $5.2 billion deal for the exclusive rights to all nationally broadcast NHL games is drawing to a close. It won't officially expire until the end of next season, but Kaplan says Rogers and the NHL are set to start talks in the new year. Rogers CEO Tony Staffieri has said the company intends to pursue a new deal.
It's something we're very interested in and something we will chase and certainly expect to be at the table.
Other sports leagues have found ways of spreading out broadcasting rights over multiple broadcasters and streamers. Kaplan says that drives up the price.
If you have six people that want your product, then you can figure a creative way to give each of the six a slice. You will get more than if you charge one the entire amount of money. And many sports have kind of come to that conclusion the last decade.
And every year, there are more ways to slice that pie. Traditional broadcasters want to cling to live sports as the last bastion of destination television. Streamers want in on the action. And even emerging platforms like FAST, ad-supported TV, are said to be considering their options. Dan Berlin, an assistant professor of sport media at Toronto Metropolitan University, says some fans may hate the changes, but not all of them.
I think if you really break it down by demographic, I think it's actually going to be easier. And they're trying to move the product to where people are, as opposed to trying to preserve an old model.
And we are underway in Florida.
And like it or not, that old model is long gone. And changes to how we watch the game are only starting as the NHL gets a sense of what works with an eye towards that new deal in 2026. Peter Armstrong, CBC News, Toronto.
Watching fitness videos on social media, though, well, that's easy. There are millions of posts, and on TikTok alone, billions of views under the hashtag FitTalk. But a new review of some popular TikTok videos on diet and exercise showed 60% of the content had misleading or even harmful information. Jennifer Yoon reports.
At a Toronto-area gym, tripods and cameras are scattered between the weights. It's an influencer-friendly gym, even lending out equipment for people recording videos of themselves pumping iron to post on social media. Among them is 25-year-old Chelsea Barastecki, a young mom who, for years, avidly followed fitness influencers on TikTok while shedding weight. She says some of the FitTalk advice did not help.
I did all the things that the fitness influencers were kind of misleading.
Now she's the one posting, and fitness videos like hers get huge numbers of views.
Here's everything I got to eat today on Bikini Prep.
In the first study of fitness content on TikTok, Australian researchers analyzed 200 videos under popular hashtags, including Fitspo and FitTalk. They found 60% of the videos contained misleading or harmful information. The peer-reviewed study was published in the academic journal Body Image.
If you're not doing lymphatic massages...
Researchers found 95% of people posting the videos did not show relevant credentials.
The reason you have a pancake ass is...
And about half the videos objectified specific body parts for both women and men. Samantha Pride, the lead researcher of the study, says the content is sometimes repeatedly offered up on platforms without the user searching for it. And it can make viewers feel like they have a personal connection to the influencer.
It's almost like
like just another friend telling them rather than a random person on the TV.
The impact of these videos need to be studied further, says Pride. Previous research suggests young people who spend more time on social media are more likely to be unhappy with their bodies.
This is a problem that is fixable.
But health tips on social media don't have to be negative. A team at Harvard University tried an experiment with mental health influencers last year, giving them information kits as well as training. Matt Mata, the lead author of the study, says influencers themselves were influenced to feature more evidence-based content.
The fact that content creators are responsible for putting this misinformation out there doesn't mean that they shouldn't be part of the solution.
Mata is hoping this model can be exported to the realm of diet and exercise. In the meantime, experts say moderation and skepticism are key in wading through fitness content on social media. Jennifer Yoon, CBC News, Toronto.
Finally tonight, the dramatic conclusion to a wild contest that saw a mother defend her family's honor against a killer. A heavyweight matchup that didn't happen in a stadium, but in the wilderness. Fat Bear Week is now in its 10th year, an annual event organized by conservationists in Alaska's Katmai National Park. It follows brown bears through feeding season as they pack on the pounds for hibernation. Solar-powered cameras live stream the action. There's even color commentary.
Sarah, with each round of Fat Bear Week, the remaining candidates just kept getting fatter and fatter.
The other semifinal matchup versus 151 Walker. Walker, you're big, but 32's bulbous bottom casts a big shadow on your ambitions.
The bears compete for votes in tournament-style bracket, and this year's final was epic. In one corner, Grazier, a female bear, last year's champion, trying to overcome tragedy. In July, Grazier's cub was killed by another bear, the massive male known as Chunk, who also advanced to the final. Pound for pound, the biggest and most dominant animal in the contest, up against the power of a mama bear. But Fat Bear Week is about more than just size. It's meant to celebrate the resiliency of brown bears. And in the end, Grazier won by more than 40,000 votes. Thank you for joining us on Your World Tonight for Wednesday, October 9th. I'm Susan Bonner. Talk to you again.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.